and welcome to Counterpressed on The Ringer and Spotify. I'm in the studio with Jessie Parker Humphreys and Kate Longhurst. Kate, it's been a while.
I feel like I've had this a few times this season.
Because you just disappear. You go off grid.
I've got a job.
This is our job.
Fake news.
Fake news.
Do you have a job, actually? That's a good way into.
Well, when was the last time
I
you
had
played
a job?
When was the last time you played a competitive game of football?
I don't know the date. Tottenham in the FA Cup.
Yeah, FA Cup game. That's
I can tell
I
you
thinking.
The date, actually. It was the 10th of February, so nearly a month since you played a competitive game of football.
It's
so do you have
long.
A job, really? Do you?
Well, I had training yesterday, and that was, let me tell you, that was a job. I was tired.
Kate Longhurst moonlighting as a professional footballer, whatever next. But you had back-to-back games postponed because of waterlogged pitches. One at home, one at Watford. You had the international break where you had a nice little holiday.
I did.
Yeah, nice little sunny
that
break.
Was nice, yeah.
I thought Charlton had gone and warm weather training.
I don't know why
training.
You thought this. I was so confused when you were. I was like, Kate must have told him. I was like, it don't look like a training camp. It's actually just playing tennis with Carla Humphrey.
Well, that's what I thought. A nice little, a bit of tennis, bit of downtime from your warm weather training camp. But I was actually maybe being a little bit too ambitious of Charlton's mid season budgets. No offence to Charlton, but a Morocco mid season training. Camp only really Chelsea in the WSL were doing those sorts of things, so
that's true. But they had no players to take, they had about four left, so they can do that.
How was your little holly bobs?
It was really nice, thanks. Yeah, just actually having some sun. When I came back, what happened to the weather? Because it wasn't this bad,
it's horrible
before I went. And I was
such
like,
a great holiday brag. Oh, guys, what happened to the weather?
Sure, I was thinking, surely I haven't acclimatised to this sunshine that much. I'm now freezing.
But also, I think it's just been non-stop, quite miserable, wet, cold, you know? I feel like we're in the thick of waterlogged season as well. That Villa pitch looked particularly bad.
Yeah, that farm.
Yeah. It's extra swampy. But, you know, it's good to have you back. Maybe this will be a bit of a run of podcast appearances and hopefully some actual games around the corner for you guys. Still,
how do you feel about having the games in hand?
Well, that's what I was going to say. You're still only 4 points back with two games in hand. That's pretty good.
Yeah, we are. But Palace have played the same amount of us and they're ahead of us on goal difference. It doesn't really change anything. I think every single game we have to try and win anyway because teams weren't or aren't dropping points so much. I think, if anything, it's probably not worked out great for, say, Southampton in terms of now they've played a game and then dropped points and know that other teams around them have games in hand that could punish them. But for us, it's just concentrating game by game. We can't do anything about the fixtures.
God, what a boring football answer. Kate Longhurst just going straight into media mode. You're like, you just got to take it game by game. Yawn.
She's fresh off having a whole piece on the Charlton website about how she's just focused on the run-in.
Cursed. I'm ready to pop the champagne.
Wait, actually, we do need to talk about your endorsement deal, which isn't really an endorsement deal, but you're the face now, effectively, of Meantime Beer.
I am.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
let's make it sound like that.
More so Charlton and Women's International Day and stuff. But yeah. No, it's cool. They're putting some money into the Charlton Women's Foundation and our academy side as well for the beers that sold. So it's a really good initiative and hopefully people can enjoy their beer.
Have you tried it?
I haven't actually. Oh. But
are they a South East
London? Do you
even
drink beer?
Crew?
You drink fruity cider.
I'm not a big beer drinker, but I'm sure I'll taste it if they
if she needs to for the photo ops.
You know.
Kate in the
She'll
photo ops just grimacing as she holds the beer to her lips.
Jessie, as our resident beer expert, are they a South East London beer, Meantime?
They are. Greenwich Meantime is the
oh, of course.
Clue in the name.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, so it's a great...
They're one of the original, they were one of the original crafty breweries that were bought out by a bigger beer company.
Like Beaver Town and all those lads.
Yeah, but they were before Beaver Town and Brewdog almost. Right. So they're very classic.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we love to see the local deals for Charlton. And obviously, we're always back in Charlton. So who have you got next up?
We've got Reading, which was called off before the international break, is now this Sunday.
Oh, instead of
FA Cup. Yeah.
Oh, so that doesn't work out too bad.
No. So.
All right. Best of luck.
Yeah.
Back
on
to
it.
The top of the table, guys. Come on. On today's show, we're not going to talk any more about Kate's postponed games because we've done that. We've covered We've covered that off. We're going to talk about North London Derby yesterday. We're going to talk about the title race. We're going to talk about that ridiculous game between Brighton and Bristol City, which was just, for anyone that was there, for the inflatable apples at half time. It just had it all. Really had it all. We're also going to answer some listener questions. So let's get into it after this. So North London Derby, it wasn't a classic, really, this game. It stunk of the sort of game that's played after an international break. Everyone looked quite leggy, a bit tired, very stodgy going forward for Arsenal. A bit gutting because I had high hopes that it would be a bit of a goal fest, and I was left very disappointed.
It wasn't the most exciting game. No, I feel like Arsenal Spurs has become one of those games where you're like, oh, it's just going to be a horrible 1-0 win for someone, which in some ways I feel like that's true derby spirit, really, isn't it? But yeah, I kind of was a bit disappointed with Spurs because I think when the lineups came out, I was shocked by the fact that I actually looked at Tottenham's bench and thought, if they can be in this game 70, 75 minutes, they're going to have a lot more options to bring on than Arsenal. I think Arsenal started really well. They seem to have this trend where they come out and they play really intensely for the first 15 minutes. And if they score, then great. And if not, it all gets a bit nervous and they get a bit worried about what they're doing. Obviously, at halftime, it was 0-0, and they do the exact same thing at second half and then they score. But my, you know, Spurs remontada never came, never materialised.
It's a shame because they were in the game. They were in the game, but going forward, nothing really quite clicked. There were a couple of moments in the first half where you could see what they were trying to do to try and play out quick on a turnover. Jess Naz and Martha Thomas and Celine Bizet trying to make things happen. But you really have to be quite clinical in those moments with your passing and be pretty efficient. And Arsenal were pretty comfortable dealing with any attacks on the break that Tottenham tried to create. There was that Naz shot that since Berber looked like she didn't really know where it was going, but it did hit the bar in the end. That was Tottenham's best chance. And I think it was a good chance, and Naz took it pretty well in the end. But it felt like it was going to take a bit of magic like that to pay off for Tottenham to really get anything in this game.
Yeah, sometimes they were trying to get forward too quickly, I felt they could carry the ball a little bit longer and then look for like little slip passes. I think especially when you've got players like Grace Clinton, Martha Thomas, Bizet that can carry the ball, I thought there were opportunities there for them to do it. They just didn't execute the passes well enough, or were trying to almost, because they were countering, it was like we have to get it forward and into their box quickly. Arsenal, I think Tottenham defended the central areas really well. I thought they blocked up quite well and were happy for Arsenal to get it wide. And we've obviously spoken about Arsenal with the amount of crosses that they put in games, and they're not...
Yesterday was another cross-a-thon. 30,
yeah,
4 accurate.
But that's the thing. Like, with Russo in the box, though, if you give her the quality, she's proven to score from crosses. But I feel they're almost desperate crosses, or they're not really... that. It's almost like we've got it wide. The only option now is to cross. Whereas I think they can be a bit patient, more patient. But the problem was they weren't drawing Tottenham out. So Tottenham kept the centre of the pitch compact. They're allowing it to go out wide. They've obviously looked at clips of Arsenal and thought, right, well, they're not really ever effective out wide, so let them have the ball out wide. And then Thomas would come down, Clinton would come down to kind of then get out wide. But Arsenal never really looked like scoring from across. So it was almost like they need to do something else and maybe keep it a little bit longer central, draw them out and then look for the central passes. But, you know, that's Tottenham's game plan. I thought they did that well. But they just looked a little bit, like you said, heavy-legged, a little bit not as sharp as they have done in some other games where they've countered quite well.
Yeah, and I thought as well, when Arsenal did have the opportunity to break the lines a little bit, that's when they did kind of coax Tottenham forward and create that space in behind. The opportunities were there. There weren't a lot of them, but that's when Arsenal looked the best going forward, when then they could try and play in behind. Problem was that Russo was doing what she does in terms of being that hold-up opportunity and then playing it out wide. But there was that really good opportunity in the first half where she held it up. The pass had to be quick, out wide to Beth Mead, and the pass was too long. And then it was like, okay, breakdown. And there weren't enough of those opportunities executed well to make the most of very finite spaces that Tottenham did allow them to have. And then, like you say, it's like, oh, we've got to resort to crosses out wide because we're not getting the space to work with down the middle. And that's why I wondered, maybe Blackstenius may have been the better option to start, with the fact that she may have created a bit more space in behind for Arsenal to play with. Russo obviously having to drop so deep, but then I think that impacted the runs that Kim Little could make, and it was like everyone was getting backed up a little bit, and you're relying so much on Caitlin Ford down the left to kind of work a bit of magic and take on a few players and cut inside, and Beth Mead, which we know she can do, but there's almost too much space for them to work with. Whereas if at Meadow Park everything's a bit more compact, I think you get a bit more success in those areas.
Yeah, I think though there's like obviously a couple of caveats maybe to be made about Arsenal's performance. Clearly the reality that they've got with players being away and injuries and players coming back from international break, you know, like they were always going to have to play Caitlin Ford, they were always going to have to play Steph Catley, both of whom have been coming back from Australia. So I think to that extent, this felt much more like a game where you did have to just get the win, because those international break games are so funny. Generally, I feel like in the first half, or at points in the first half, it felt like Tottenham's midfield were able to win back the ball better and release those players. And I think as the game went on, that's actually the area Arsenal sort of tightened up, which meant that even though they were only 1-0 up, it never really felt like Spurs were going to get another good chance, even when they were bringing Beth England on. I respect them for putting Amy Turner up front for a bit as well. I was like, that's proper going for it. But then there was no like balls to justify that kind of going for it. And maybe that's just an element of like some of those Spurs players still adjusting to playing in those kind of games in front of those kind of crowds, because it definitely felt like some of the players who came off the bench were quite lethargic in their own way. But Spurs have had their own injuries, you know, like Ashley Neville and Drew Spence were both coming back and playing matches for the first time in a long time. I think, yeah, from an Arsenal perspective, I'm inclined to be a bit more benefit of the doubt on them on this game just because of the context of it. But I also think it's interesting because what has happened earlier in the season has made that kind of performance feel more under the microscope. Because, of course, you're like, so can Arsenal still play against these low block teams? I don't know. And like on the Blackstenius thing, I'm like, well, it doesn't really work because there is no space for it to run because Spurs are happy to sit relatively deep. So I think for me, it's more about having wingers who are able to go past those players and then knowing what their next pass is going to be. But there were a couple of moments where there was one point where Ford nutmegged Neville and then she's like there on the edge of the box and it's almost like she doesn't know what to do and she just passes it back to Steph Catley. And I'm like, well, you've just allowed everyone to reset. So you've used that nice bit of skill. And that was just one of those moments where I was like, it's that element that I think still feels like the problem for us.
And that kind of thing happened a couple of times where the desire to kind of reset and be patient and involve more people in the build-up play then lost the advantage and opportunity that you did have when you did create that space. And I do think the same with kind of that Russo Beth Mead pass is like, there's the space, there's the timing, and it's like you kind of go back to square one when you miss that opportunity. Is that Arsenal's last Emirates game?
No, they've got Leicester. They added Leicester as an extra game.
Right, because I was going to... It's one that we've talked about before in terms of their record at the Emirates. And we know they've cracked when it comes to attendance, or tickets sold, shall I say. One for the true heads. No, they have cracked it when it comes to attendance and fans. But I don't think they really mastered yet an Emirates performance and what that looks like in terms of feeling
comfortable. Surely the Chelsea game was that.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's because that game just makes me want to like yeet myself off a cliff.
But... No, you're probably right. You're probably right. But I still don't feel like I see them so dominant and impressive at the Emirates as I've ever seen them, bar that Chelsea game. Oh, yeah, we'll say that was out and out. Chelsea were really poor, but you know, Arsenal were impressive that day. But I still think in terms of the consistency and how impressive that they can be at Meadow Park, I'm yet to kind of see that at the Emirates. And obviously they've played, on the balance of things, so much more at Meadow Park, so no wonder they feel more comfortable in that space. But yeah, I'm still feeling like I expect a lot more of them at the Emirates whenever I go to games, and I maybe leave feeling not totally satisfied.
I wonder if something you're picking up on there, which I understand why you have that feeling, is because I think the nature of those Emirates games, with the number of people that go to them, it makes every match feel like a moment. And I think some of those games whereby, regardless of whether Arsenal would have played better or worse, like, we've seen Arsenal get kind of stodgy results over Tottenham over a couple of seasons. You know, they've had some big wins, but they've also had some moments where they've needed players to bail them out late on. And I think if this game, if this game had been played at Meadow Park, you'd have just been like, kind of stodgy 1-0 win. But because it's at the Emirates, you're like, you want Arsenal to blow them away and
win 4-0. I suppose because at the Emirates, they have done that against Spurs. Their record against Spurs at the Emirates is very good and very impressive.
But I guess my general point is that it's hard for a team if they're going to play half their home matches at the Emirates this season, which is amazing. It's hard if a number of those games are kind of against, you know, mid-table sides, for those to be every one of those to be really big moments, because that's just like unsustainable really for anything.
Also, I think for the opposition it's almost like a cup final atmosphere. You're thinking, I'm playing in front of 60,000 people here.
Yeah,
what do you
match
do
it,
you're
right?
Like you kind of it's more important to not concede than, okay, what are the risks we're going to take going forward, because it is a slightly bigger pitch as well. Teams might be a little bit apprehensive of like going forward because you're going to leave gaps for Arsenal to attack in. So I think as well, sometimes it can also be the opposition in terms of, this is a big moment for them. It is just another league game, but you can't help but feel that adrenaline of like playing in front of a bigger crowd and at a bigger stadium. You do kind of raise your game, not intentionally, but it's just, that's just what happens, because you're almost fighting for every ball more, because you know you want a reaction off the crowd and you want to frustrate them. So for Arsenal, the main thing, like you said, was they had to get the win. That was the main thing. I don't think they'll come out of that going, oh, the performance wasn't like exciting. They still did a job. They were still comfortable. They still deserved to win. And like I said, you've got players flying halfway across the world to play a couple of days later. Like, that's an incredible win for them, really, because if they'd have dropped points, then that's probably the title chance over. So I don't think they'll be too bothered about what the performance looked like.
Yeah, I'm sure they're not bothered. And I agree with you. I do think the heightened expectation of the Emirates changes things, and it's perhaps unrealistic. I guess the difference is that maybe my just expectations of Arsenal are always at a level where I expect teams to just put their foot down a little bit more. And I think Chelsea do that very well, even when their performances aren't so great. I think they're good at blowing away teams to kind of maybe cover themselves a little bit more and make performances look better than reality they might be. I don't think Arsenal do that enough. It's like that punishing mentality, which I think you can deliver almost even more when you're in front of a big crowd. And I think Chelsea have made teams look very silly at Stamford Bridge, and some of those games that haven't been so crucial. Arsenal have won crucial Emirates games when they've needed to, and then I'm like, okay, this is the one where you get that result, and they've done that against Spurs in the past. It's like, I think that the international break thing has a massive weight in yesterday's performances and is kind of the result of what we've seen, but I still, on the balance, feel like I want to see more from those Emirates' performances. I think the Chelsea one will go down as, you know, amazing, but like, where's more?
Well, it is also interesting generally about Arsenal, because, you know, their goal difference is a long way off Chelsea and City, and that could be a problem for them. And I do think that those kind of games, like the Spurs games, I actually even think the United game was one where I was like, you have this team on the ropes, like, just go in for the kill and like get more goals, and they couldn't find that. They've got quite a nice running from here. They have Chelsea and City, but like the other games aren't really, they're like lower down the table, but they are going to have to find goals, I think, if they want to really feel like they're genuinely in the title race towards the end of the season. But I think also the reality with that and where they find those goals and being able to push on is then related to the previous performances, because it is a bit like, you know, not only the Emirates thing, like what Kate's saying, but also if you're Spurs and you've kept a clean sheet against Arsenal already this season, then you're going to go into that game and be like, we believe we can defend against this team. And I actually think that was, you know, when Spurs looked wobbly in that first 10-15 minutes, and they did, they looked like a bit overawed, but they got through it. And then it was like they relaxed and they were like, okay, no, actually, we think we can, you know, like hold the centre, let them have the ball out wide, and we feel like we'll do that. And that's because they know they have done it. And that's almost the problem about when those previous performances have happened. Teams get it into their heads, I think, that they can get something. Whereas I think, for example, and Arsenal almost used to have the opposite, right? Teams just knew Arsenal would blow them away. And now it feels like Chelsea and City are the two teams who, like, sides sort of like roll over for them at points, especially when that first or second goal goes in.
Yeah, and that's why I think we spoke about it last week ahead of this game, and it's a conversation that always happens with the Arsenal men as well, is that if they don't get those early goals, tension gets there. And I do think in those games where Chelsea and City kind of have dominated, like you say, Jesse, it's like that first goal gives them that upper hand and teams rarely claw a way back in. Arsenal give teams too much early on and let them build confidence. And I think the expectation has to be that you need to just be a bit more ruthless. And I think City, we've talked about City not being ruthless enough, especially last season. And now I think they've found again that punishing mentality. I think Chelsea have had it all of their title winning campaigns. But it's like, how do you find that next level to build that dominance? Because you look at Arsenal's results this season and the teams that have picked points off them, and that does allow other teams to get confidence because you know that you could be in a game and get something. What's the aura around that team now? And I think so much of that as well can come from how big those results and performances are at the Emirates and what people feel like when they go, not the fans, but the teams and the players. What's the intimidation that they're going to get from that? Not just a chance to be at the Emirates, because like that Liverpool game is prime example. Like, so many teams can try and get a result when I think they're trying to build something at the Emirates where it's like it's such a strong home for them. I just don't see that yet.
I mean, to be fair, I didn't bother to go to the game because I was so certain Arsenal would win, so they built it for me.
So, there you go. Very true. All right, let's talk title race next. So you hinted it there, Jesse, looking at Arsenal's run-in. But given where we are right now in the season, there are 7 games to go in the league. We've obviously got Chelsea got Champions League. We've got some Conti Cup semi-finals this week and the FA Cup. But in terms of WSL action, 7 games to go. It's very tight. Chelsea top by goal difference. City on the same amount of points, just behind. Arsenal 3 points back, but like we say, fairly big gap in goal difference, 10 goals behind City. And United well off the pace, 12 points back. Liverpool join on points with United, but goal difference is a bit of a way back. But there's a chance Liverpool could nick 4th spot, which would be absolutely iconic. So I will be there. But let's focus on the top first, and then we'll maybe get into some Manchester United discourse because it's another interesting result for them. But Chelsea, Jesse, that game yesterday, a lot of positives. Kat Macario, debut and goal. Wow.
Oh, I was so happy for her. She looked so happy and it made me so happy. And then she took the goal really well. Unfortunately, looked really sharp. Yeah, I think Chelsea were good. There was like a couple of bits of wobble, sort of like Chelsea started really strong first 10 minutes. Then there was like a little break in play and Willie Kirk adjusted some stuff and it took Chelsea a bit of a while to sort of take back control. But I think once the first goal went in, again, kind of like what we were saying, it just felt like they were only going to go on and score more. I thought Myra Ramirez had a really good game despite the referee's best efforts. And she obviously got her first WSL goal. So Harry Edwards tweeted saying, this is the 4th time 3 or more Chelsea women players have scored their first WSL goal for the club in the same game. Because Natalie Bjorn got hers, Katarina Macario got hers, and Myra Ramirez got hers.
That's incredible stat.
Four times.
It's telling me that Chelsea's squad is too big and too many rotations, but there you go. That's what I'm getting from that stat.
Too many goal scorers.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but I think obviously in some ways though, the Macario thing makes me a bit nervous because really exciting to see her play for Chelsea. There was a point where I was almost like forgotten we'd signed her. And I think it was good that she looked sharp, but I also feel like she's been out for a really, really long time. And it's great that she came on, it's great that she got a goal, but realistically, there's probably still going to be patience needed. And my worry is because she scored after 5 minutes, everyone's like, woo, Camagario.
I was even surprised to see her on the team sheet because her whole trajectory back has been classic Chelsea, just still a little bit mysterious about when her date is. And at one point it was like November.
To be fair to Emma Hayes, she said before the international break that Kat would play a game during the international break, presumably like at Cobham, and then there was a chance that she'd be
Yeah, but how many times have we heard that before?
I know,
and it hasn't materialized.
But that's the Emma Hayes mystery, not on Kat Macari.
No, obviously, that's about the club. But there, I swear, there's one point in the summer or September when it was like, oh, maybe November, maybe December, and then it was January. And then it was February.
I think from a Chelsea perspective, I think when she joined the club, there was a potential expectation that she would be ready by November. And I think from a Chelsea perspective, it's very much like when Lauren James joined the club. Obviously, she hadn't had one serious injury, but rather a lot of little injuries, but wanting to wait until the player was ready. And Kat's been in full team training since January. She had one training session with Sam Kerr before Sam Kerr did her ACL. Jeez. So they had one crossover training session. So she's basically been in full training for, what, 2 months now at this point before they've even put her on the bench. So I think that says less about I think it's hard to know exactly where she's been in terms of fitness, because it feels like Chelsea were just like, we're not going to rush this at all.
Well, also now it's almost like, oh, thank God for that because of the injuries. It's like you really need her now, actually. So the patience in a way has sort of paid off. Obviously, you wouldn't have liked those other injuries, but the timing has worked better than it could have been, especially in the Champions League. Depending how much game time she can have, you're going to need that without Kerr, without Fischl. And overall, I know the Chelsea midfield is still not quite what fans would like it to be, and is still...
Oh my God, this was like a merry-go-round in midfield. It was so funny. I don't know what was going on, but it was Jelena Trankovic, Shuka Nuskin and Erin Cuthbert, and it was like they were a spinning wheel and you didn't know which one was going to be at the base.
That's the mystery. You've got to keep Leicester guessing.
I know. And I think to a certain extent, I'm like, don't hate it as a tactic, because that it allows you to sort of man mark players if you want. It allows you to be very flexible on the ball. It is, you pull teams out of position as a result if they're following one player. But also at points I would look up and be like, there's just no one there. And then Neve Charles would like just shimmy in to try and receive the ball. And I was like, I'm not sure if it's working yet, but I get the concept. But
okay, so I feel like, I'm not sure if it's working yet. I get the concept. Is the story of Chelsea season? Is maybe that's the tagline for 23-24?
No, I don't think so.
I know you think there's more structure.
I think we're getting to the point where, because of the injuries, stuff's having to like innovate a little bit more.
Okay. But I feel the midfield's been a bit up in the air all this season.
I mean, to be fair, a midfield, an Emma Hayes midfield, that bit is always up in the air. That's like just chuck it in the air and see which players land on the pitch.
Yes, okay, yeah, that makes more sense. And in terms of Chelsea's run-in, the game against Arsenal at Stamford Bridge on the 15th of March is their toughest game. How are you feeling about that one? Because actually, compared to maybe their rivals in this, their run-in is pretty nice. Bar that Arsenal game, when you look at the other games they've got West Ham away, we've got the Champions League games obviously to contend with, they've got Spurs away, Villa at home, Liverpool away, Bristol City penultimate game, and then Manchester United away. And Manchester United are just not the same beast this season than they were last season, and Chelsea's record against them is good anyway, so it's all going to come down to that Arsenal game.
Yeah, I don't want to think about that.
Well, you have to, because we're doing a title race conversation, Jesse.
Yeah, I do think a lot comes down to that Arsenal game. I think if Chelsea win, even with the Champions League, they should feel like they're in a strong position. But obviously, it is going to be interesting, because then maybe they're asking Arsenal to do them a favour when they go to play Manchester City. And if Manchester City win that game, then maybe we're just going all the way down to goal difference. And it's only three at the moment, so that could swing very, very... A team only needs one massive win. Yeah, but it's funny, because my brother was talking about, when we were talking about Arsenal's goal difference, he was saying Bristol City. And I was like, but until the Brighton game, Bristol City weren't conceding that many goals. And I think the only reason Bristol City conceded that many goals in that game is because they were going for it. There's not been obvious gimmies this season in terms of just
at one point Spurs
goals.
Were the gimme, but they've managed to tie up, because
they shipped about 14 in two games,
so, but they've tightened up a little bit now,
and obviously Chelsea's biggest win was Villa, so. But yeah, I don't know, I think for Chelsea it feels like, because they're in so many competitions, they are really in a position of just having to take things game by game. Whereas I think if you're City, you're like, okay, they are also in Conti Cup and FA Cup, but surely you're just like, it focuses on league game.
Yeah, and Conti Cup could change this week in that semi-final if they lose or whatever happens in that. Let's talk about City. beating Everton 2-1 on Saturday. Again, not a classic. Again, after the international break, kind of what you expect. Everton looked really poor. Felt like they didn't really give enough of a game. They've got injury issues. They've got structural issues because of those injury issues. And everyone looked really slow and a bit crap. But
say what you really
think. Well, sorry, I just have to, you know, I play it as I see it. But another win for them, and that's 9 in a row again. And I think it's the third time they've done 9 in a row under Gareth Taylor. So we know that they love putting together these massive winning runs, which, you know, put them in prime position for the title, or, you know, in the past maybe in Champions League. But it's about sustaining that. But where do you see City right now in terms of, like, I certainly put them as favourites and have felt good about them since that back end of last year. But do you still think they're in prime position and look good enough to hold off what Chelsea can do in the back end of the season?
Yeah, I think it speaks volumes of that they've won 9 in a row and Chelsea still are there. That's what it requires from a team to kind of keep up with Chelsea, because Chelsea are just relentless. We've seen that over the last few years. But I think this City team looked different this year in terms of, bar the Brighton game, which, I mean, they had enough chances to win that game and Brighton took their chance, but they've just looked like they've been in control of, like, the big games as well, and they haven't faltered when things are maybe not going well, like even with the two sendings off early in the season. I think if you'd looked at that maybe in the last couple of seasons, I think that would have really rocked them and they would have gone on to lose that game, whereas they've pulled out some really big results this season. I like the balance of the team. I like the structure of the team. They haven't had, like, a huge turnover of players as well in the last couple of years, and I think that's probably helped. I think the form of Hemp and Kelly, not necessarily just with goal scoring, like, I don't think Chloe Kelly has scored a lot. Well, I can't even remember past this last game, so actually I can't remember.
We're asking the wrong person.
You're like, I know Lauren Hemp scored at the weekend.
I know Lauren Hemp scored. But I just think, like, the form of them in terms of what they're producing on the pitch.
The,
like,
performances, the, not
the
just
performances, the chances they're creating. The link up, Bunny Shaw. We had a conversation earlier in the season. Is she an elite player? I think she's really starting to prove, like, she's such a huge cog in that team and is ruthless and can finish in the big moments. And yeah, she does miss some chances, but she's also scored a lot of goals for them as well. So I really like the balance of the team. I think Yui Hasegawa just, like, controlling that midfield as well. Laura Coombs sort of, like, coming in from the wide into central areas. I thought she was really unlucky. Courtney Brosnan made a fantastic save, but Laura Coombs is always a threat going forward as well. And defensively, they're just so solid at the back. And, you know, you've got to have a really strong back line, I think, to win the league. And I just think they look so comfortable at the moment. I think
The reason I look at Jesse is because we had
I was beefing with Karen Carney about
Jesse
this.
Was beefing with Karen Carney. So,
oh, about that it wins you
it
titles.
Wins you the title.
But you do have to have a strong,
no, I agree.
Strong,
I think,
back line.
I agree with you. I think that has been the difference for City this season, is where I've always felt their back line has kind of given me the ick a little bit. I do think this season their defence looks much more robust. They've only conceded 9 goals, which is the fewest since 1920 season, so it's their best.
1920, I was like, wow,
yeah,
over 100 years.
Yeah. I didn't realize we had stats from there.
No. Dick Herlady versus Manchester City, that was the last time they had a good defensive record. No, it's their fewest, the goals that they've conceded at this point in the season since 1920. They were on a bit of a clean sheet stomp until the weekend. So I do think that solidity at the back has made a massive difference. Jesse, do you want to talk about your Sky Sports beef and the reason we were chuckling?
I agree that obviously, like, having a good defence is important. I just don't like cliches that aren't true. What annoyed me, not what annoyed me, but I was just like, I think it's actually really interesting that Karen Carney said, you know, clean sheets win you titles, which is, you know, it's not on Karen Carney saying that. It's a fairly common thing that gets said. And I don't know whether this is just a Chelsea specific thing, but Chelsea have not kept the most clean sheets or not conceded the fewest goals in 3 of their past 4 title winning seasons. It's normally been that they just sort of blow teams away and they don't really care if they concede one because they'll score 3 or 4. Now, that's not to say that that won't mean it's different this season, although it is also obviously interesting. I thought even that, you know, when Carney was saying this, at the point before the City game had kicked off, Chelsea were top of the league on goals scored, because that's what you go to next when goal difference is equal. So I think when you're scoring a lot, which City have been doing as well, you know, they're not far behind Chelsea in that sense. You don't have to worry about it as much. But at the same time, you can argue that maybe in, for example, the 1-0 win over Chelsea, I do think City felt confident in their defence and that enabled them to sit back. I said after that game, and I stand by this, if Chelsea equalise, I think you sit there and say that was silly of them to do. But they got away with it because it's almost like they've got that belief in the defence. And I think that ties into the wider point, which is also something that Sky said before this game, which I think was right, which was feeling that City just have a bit more grit to them than they have previously. And I think that actually applies all over the pitch, not just in defence, but just that sort of willingness and belief that, like, they'll make the tackles, they'll win the ball, and they'll, like, keep danger further away.
Better game management, better street smart, better shithousery. It all comes into the little triangle of success that I've just created. Shithouse at the top, game management here. And what was the other one I said? Street smart. That's smart. The triangle of magic.
The triangle of
success.
People
have been using that for years to come.
But the reason we were laughing as well on Saturday is that when you, and I text you straight back away saying, you know, 21-22 season, who had the most clean sheets? Manuel Zinsberger. 22-23 season, who had the most clean sheets by a fairly big margin? Mary Earps. So, and she had more she had six more clean sheets than Ann-Kathrine Berger had. Now, obviously, Chelsea, if they rotate goalkeepers, it will impact that. But still, yeah, clean sheets does not a title-winning side make.
Well, and it might.
There's
and
a difference between defence and clean sheets as well.
Well, yeah, but with clean sheets and goals scored, and it might this season. It just annoyed me when people say stuff, and I'm like, but that's just like not recently been statistically true.
Well, when you have that foundation, obviously, like we said.
Can I just put out a disclaimer? I did not say that wins them the title.
I know. Chloe just looked at me and it made me laugh.
No, we were
they
just...
They can build off it.
Someone on Twitter called me... Wait a minute, let me find what they called me, like, patronising. I was like, it's not my fault. She's wrong.
Yeah. Just go on FB Ref, guys. That is
the
place
if to be. Can look it up in 30 seconds whilst I'm watching Sky, surely they've got a researcher who could have done
no,
that.
No, I think it's one of those ones where you say it and it's like Kate was saying, it's like the context of basically defence can win you titles in a way, but...
I didn't use that phrase though. Just putting it out there.
I'm going to quote for
before
you
I start
on
getting
Twitter. Just a random tweet. Yeah.
When you look at the run-in that Man City have, it's not too bad either. They've got the Manchester derby. It's at home at the Etihad, I believe. You just don't really know what Manchester United are going to do. But I'd look
nothing.
At that game.
We do know what they're going to
do. Nothing. No, but I feel like that might be an occasion where we see a little bit more. But maybe I'm being too nice to them.
Have we seen anything from Manchester United on any occasion this season?
No.
Like any of the big occasions?
No.
Not at Old Trafford.
No.
Not Stamford Bridge.
No.
Not
but
Emirates.
They played. They played all right at the Etihad last season. Got a point.
Yeah, but it was different United.
I know, but I'm like, maybe channel some of that energy. Anyway, they've got the Manchester derby around the corner. They've got Liverpool, they've got West Ham, Bristol City, and their penultimate game is against Arsenal, which is the toughest in that run, really. And they finish away at Aston Villa. They have a nice-ish record against Villa, bar a bit of a...
That City-Arsenal game, penultimate game of the season, is going to be wild.
It's going to be amazing.
That's going to be like, that could
be really
I really
hope
crazy.
It's still a three-way open race because that'll just, like, that'd be crazy.
But, I mean, my stock is still very high on City. Jesse, it's different for you because you've got your Chelsea allegiances and obviously you...
What do you mean, though?
Yeah, you've got a bloody Chelsea shirt on. Shut up. I know you're trying to sort of stay cool, calm and a bit sort of anything can happen. But genuinely, what do you feel about the threat of City right now?
Well, I think they are playing really well. They can focus on the league. The thing that I think is going to be interesting for City, and I genuinely don't know either way, but Chelsea have been in this position every season. Like, Chelsea never win the league by a lot, right? What's almost been so impressive about it is that every year they're in this exact kind of situation where they're level on points with someone. It's changed over the years who it's been. You know, they've done it against United, they've done it against Arsenal, done it against City, and they find a way to finish top. What I'm intrigued about with City is that grit that we've talked about, that determination, which I think is there. Do they have that to, like, hold on as the squeeze sets in. And maybe, you know, they won't need it in the same way. Because, for example, if Chelsea lose to Arsenal, then suddenly City will have a buffer. But they still have to go to every game knowing they have to win. And I do think that's a different kind of pressure. And there's not necessarily players in that City team who've really, truly experienced that kind of pressure. And in some ways, that's super exciting for them. It's a young team, and I think that can bring them together. You know, everyone's kind of got to start from somewhere in terms of doing that. I was kind of just thinking when Chelsea were beating Leicester by 4 goals after watching City play Everton. And you're right, you know, Everton had no fit centre-backs. Everton didn't look very good. And City end up winning 2-1. It wasn't nervy at the end, but again, it'd be
it was
like
closer than it
game,
should have been.
There were moments where it only takes one error or one fantastic shot. You know, like the Bennison goal was amazing, but that comes from a Kiara Keating error. And there was another one. She did another one earlier in the game. And it's those kind of moments where I'm like, okay, but like you're only going to get away with so much of that. Do you have the mental strength to like really push on and get there? And when you look at players like Lauren Hemp, Chloe Kelly, like what they've done with England, like that's mentality as well. Like, so it's not they don't have that ability, but I still think it's different in a title running.
Yeah, and it's different as a group because a lot of these players, the only thing that they've won with City, for some of them an FA Cup, although there's not many of them who were involved in that, and then the Conti Cup. In terms of tapping into that group mentality and saying, like, Chelsea can do that every time. So, like, we've done it before, guys. Do you remember that time when it was backs against the wall, et cetera, et cetera?
Not in a Conti Cup, though.
Conti Cup curse lives on.
We can only beat Bristol City.
City's next game, the team that they lost to, Brighton. I don't see Brighton doing that again. But we talk about Spurs trying to tap into that mentality of the result that they got against Arsenal.
Free scoring Brighton.
Finally, they're here. And I guess we have to, by default, include Manchester United in this conversation.
Do we?
Well, the reason I want to talk about them is because we have to talk about them in terms of how badly they're doing. So it's not a question of saying they're in the title race, because they're certainly not, because of how big the gap is. But it's a chance to talk about them and how poor they've been this season again, and how surprised I am that there hasn't maybe been a change in coach right now, because the performances have been so disappointing. And to find themselves this far back at this point in the season, it's a hell of a drop off. Even with everything that's gone on with change of players and everything, it's a hell of a gap.
They've almost just lost their threat. They've lost, I don't know, like when you go and play Man United, the way they've built themselves the last couple of seasons, you'd always think, we have to be on it defensively because they will punish us if we leave gaps, and they've got a lot of pace going forward, so they're frightening on the break. You had on a bad shape, like just constantly on the overlap, getting back in defensively. Like, her missing has made a huge difference to that team. Obviously Russo with their hold up play and connecting the passes, it's not really happened for any of the forwards that have come in for them this season. And I watched a bit of their game yesterday, and I thought first half they looked quite solid and looked the better team. And then second half, it was just like waiting for West Ham to score. West Ham actually probably had the better chances, apart from Rach Williams at 1-1. She should have scored. I don't know if you saw it, but
I don't think surely the ref would have blown for her.
He didn't,
blocking.
Though. He Marcus. Didn't. Like, he let it play on, and she's missed an open goal. Like, it doesn't really matter because they're sort of just, it's out of them and Liverpool for that fourth position. But I don't know, they've just lost a bit of threat, and I think they've almost lost that belief themselves. They didn't even look that bothered or like that they wanted to kind of change anything yesterday. It was just like, oh, here we go again, like we're not really beating a team that we should beat.
Did you ever believe the Pot Noodle Chigwell Construction Stadium would become such a fortress?
Since it's become that name, yes. Because
they knew.
That's a frightening place to go.
I mean, think of concrete, what else?
Boiling water.
Boiling water.
The toilets are nicer.
Cement.
The wobbly gantry for Jilly to climb up in the wind.
Yeah, loads. Scaffolding. Yeah. You got it all. Mm, that's a fortress. It's been quite a fall from grace, I guess, is what we're saying, Jesse.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think those issues have been there the whole season, and realistically, it just feels like Skinner doesn't have anything at his disposal to fix them. It feels like he's run out of ideas, I think, and I kind of feel like, I know she scored and then missed an open goal, but I felt like Rach Williams starting even felt a bit like that, of just being like, oh, you know, she likes me. so I'll play her. But, you know, she's been one of his, like, big vocal defenders, obviously, and they've obviously known each other for a very long time. But I think that in itself just felt like a real sort of lack of ambition and vision about this team. I can understand why he's not gone yet, because I think right like now, like, what's the point? Like, if you're bringing someone in, what are they really going to do? Champions League's long gone, and I mean, I'm sure United fans will care whether they finish fourth or fifth, but does the club? Potentially not. I feel like really if they wanted to make a change, they needed to do it over Christmas to give someone the time with the squad to come in to be able to build something new. So I think the concerning thing about United is that there's a part of me that says, what if they do offer a new deal? Because obviously we've sort of seen, you know, Catherine Batter reporting earlier that Taylor's going to get this 3.5-year deal from City. Obviously, Idavel got the deal from Arsenal. It feels like everyone's really big on consistency at the moment because Chelsea are going to have a change. And there's like a real part of me that thinks maybe United will just be like, yeah, we'll do the same. Because also in some ways you look at Taylor and like, oh, he finished fourth and, you know, now City are really good again. But that for me is the biggest concern from a United perspective. Just this feeling of like, maybe he won't go.
Well, I guess it'll be what the new investors, how much influence they have as well on the women's football side. Because the expectation is that they're going to want to do something, but actually how much they care and how much they see everything and want to have influence, I think, will make a big impact. Because they might be like, oh, we haven't got time for it right now. Let's just throw them a new contract so we'd have to worry about it for a bit. Or it's, no, we actually want to get stuck in and shake things up and make a change. And there's, you know, other contract things to deal with, as there always is at Manchester United. So they haven't got a lot of time, and their priority is going to be the men's team. So it might be that they just say, ah, we don't have time to deal with it right now.
Do you know another big loss for them as well, I think, is Martin Ho. From speaking to players at Man United, he took all the coaching sessions and he was a big part of how they played and how they'd set up. And they've obviously lost him this season, so I don't know who they've brought in. But if Mark Skinner's not doing necessarily the coaching as such, of course it's going to be his ideas as well. I'm not saying he just stands there and doesn't do anything, but
I could believe it.
But I think he was a big part of that. Like, when I've spoken to people that have played for Man United or are there, like, he was a big part of what they were trying to do and the way that they would train and the ideas and tactical kind of ideas that they had behind everything. So when you lose someone like that, you've got to replace them as well, or you've got to be strong enough to kind of do those sessions yourself. And I don't know if that's kind of rocked them a little bit as well, because it's not just about players. Like, as a player, you have belief in your coaches, and if you're maybe not getting that back, listen, I haven't played for Mark Skinner, so I don't know what he's like as a coach and a manager, but, you know, if you're not having that trust in him, or when things are going wrong and maybe a tactical change, he's making the wrong decisions or doesn't know how to fix a problem, all of a sudden as a player you start losing confidence in that. So then it's almost like, well, what are we doing now? And there's no solution. So I think that can have a big impact as well.
Well, and the other thing is if you're a player, you know he doesn't have trust in you, because every week he gets up and says, oh, I can't play Rena Guerrero because she has to take, what are we on, like 9 months learning how to play Mark Skinner's football at Manchester United.
Sometimes I forget about all the signings that you just never appear.
There's not even any like internal consistency in what he says, because obviously she came from Spain, but Jacy came from Spain and she plays all the time. And then Lucia Garcia came from Spain and she plays a medium amount of the time. So, but you know, like, if you, from that mentality, if you're a player, I'd be sat there thinking, well, why is he out? He signed me. And then every week he's saying, oh, I wish I'd signed different players and I don't want to play this player. And I'd be like, fuck off.
Maybe they need to say that. I don't know.
Ariane has asked, not really a question, but I'd love you to touch on Terland and what an incredible goal scoring season she is having. She's in the running for Golden Boot despite playing for Brighton and often feeding off scraps, which is a perfect opportunity to talk about the chaos that was Bristol City Brighton yesterday. I was driving back from North London Derby and Fop Mob was just going non-stop on my phone. Nearly crashed the car. No, I didn't, but it was like flashing up. Brighton eventually beating Bristol City.
Why didn't you have your
City.
Phone on Do Not Disturb while you're driving, Flo? Very dangerous.
because I like to see the football stuff, because then I don't feel I need to know what's going on. But yes, Brighton beating Bristol City 7-3. And Bristol City have been involved in a couple of these back-and-forthy games, which is frustrating because you watch them and you're like, oh, they're in it. And they're like, oh, no, they're out of it. No, they're in it. And it's been a really tough, nearly there season for them. And I think it's going to be really frustrating if they do go down. But yet another example of Bristol City really being able to kind of punch above their weight in many ways and having a very clear game plan and sticking to it. But Brighton, once you wait for a couple of goals, damn, they all come at once, I guess.
Yeah, I do think Brighton have looked better going forward, even if I think defensively they still look pretty wobbly. Bristol City's best asset this season, I think, has been that ability to score. And obviously that question's about Elizabeth Turland, and I think, you know, she's had a great season. But Emily Thestrop as well is also, yeah, like, I really enjoy, if you look at the XG over performance table at the moment, top is Manchester City and second is Bristol City. And I'm like, wow, that's the two ends of the WSL right now. But yeah, Bristol City do have this great never say die attitude. They were 4-1 down. They get two goals back in 3 minutes, Brooke Aspen and then Emily Thestrup. And then, bless them, I think, understandably, they were like, well, we've got to go for it. Look, they're now 6 points off the team ahead of them. So I can see why they went for it to get the draw, but they were so open. And I think, again, Brighton just showing that they do have a good squad. They have those players of quality they can bring on, and they brought on Madison Haley for Turland, and I thought, not seen a lot of this season, she's been injured, but she looked really good. She got the fifth goal with some really nice movement, and then Vicky Lasada scores a penalty, and it was just like, and then yeah, it felt like it all kind of fell apart for Bristol in that, but it was a great game to watch.
Yeah, it was loads of fun, and we had the halftime apple madness as well, which is always
why
a
is
highlight
it apples?
Because they're
Bristol
sponsored by a cider.
Okay.
So it has to be apples.
Got you.
Can you be
else?
Doing hop rolling on
yeah, you should.
The valley pitch
time
in this meantime deal?
Yeah. One for you, because I'm wondering if you might have any West Ham intel on this. NS has asked, why isn't Christy Mewis getting any playing time? She's getting some play time, but not as much as maybe people would expect.
She's rubbish. No, I'm joking.
I imagine
she's struggling with her Achilles. I thought it was probably a fitness thing
because over the last couple of years she's struggled with injury. But I was really hoping that she would come and, you know, be able to get into a bit of rhythm and build something. But she has just been a bit in and out, stop start.
Yeah, I think when she joined, she was still coming back from injury and probably needed a little bit of time. I mean, they're sort of running out of games. I don't know how much time she needs, but she's come on in some games. But yeah, I do. From what I've heard, I think she's just struggling a little bit with her Achilles, so that's probably impacting her game time.
Jesse Grace has asked, any guesses how many yellow cards Kate McCabe is going to finish this season with? She's already got...
How many games are left? Seven.
She's already got seven, which is what she got last season. She's already equaled last season's total.
Wow.
So
what a gal.
She's going to be double figures, definitely, because she's averaging basically one every other game, right?
I'm trying to figure out, because if she carries on going at the rate she's going at, wouldn't she get a 2-game ban and then she'd miss the City game?
Yeah, I was going to say, if she gets 10, that's two.
But maybe that wouldn't take her quite far enough.
No,
she wouldn't. She'd be back for
10.
The City game. So I expect, based on the fact that we know Katie McCabe apparently cancelled her yellow cards, she'll get 8, 9, 10 in the next three games, miss two games,
yes,
back in time for the City game.
She needs
to just not get booked.
Yeah, but she needs...
She can't do that.
She can't not get booked, so she has to be strategic about it in order to not miss the City game. You're so right. So who would she be playing in order to get the yellow card? So it's the games before City.
We'll see yellow cards against Chelsea, Villa and Bristol. She'll then be banned for less at Everton and be back in time for City.
What about Conti Cup? Does that count?
Yeah, that probably does count.
So she could pick one up in the Conti Cup.
Then she'd miss Bristol and Leicester. So
yeah,
that would work
maybe
as
that
well.
Would work.
Better. All right, we will be clipping this up if we're right, because we were right last time, so you best believe we're doing it again. And then finally, a question from Kez. Great question. With Bovril being Beardy's celebration drink, what drink would the rest of the managers celebrate with? So we know that Emma Hayes does love a beer. She's had a bottle of beer on the sidelines before in like title winning celebrations.
Something during the game.
No.
Save Emma.
But any other any other drinks of choice? I feel like who's going to be a hot chockey kind of person?
Carlo or WKD?
Carlo or definitely WKD. Brianne Skinner hot chock?
I'm trying to think of like a really sloppy drink.
Cup of soup. Brianne Skinner, cup of soup.
Or a pot noodle on the sideline.
What else would other managers would drink? I feel like Mark Skinner would go for like a really posh, like Twinings herbal tea type thing.
Twinings mix, like cranberry,
just
fruity
so you
one.
Know he's better than you.
What about Willie Kirk and Iron Brew? Is that
yeah,
too?
Yeah. Definitely Willie Kirk Iron Brew.
Oh, yeah.
I can't even think of it. I know. You've got in the league. This is bad.
I'm trying to think. What about Taylor? What
Gareth Taylor, he'd be just a beer, wouldn't he? He'd just be like
yeah,
a little
solid.
Heineken.
Boiling,
yeah.
boiling
yeah.
water.
Don't just hide about just a shot of vodka. That's, like, that's
no, he's an espresso man. Just a little
espresso.
Shot of espresso.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Jaeger bomb.
Oof, gross. Someone's gonna have a shot of Sambuca on the sideline as well. I'm trying to think of any.
What about like a Scandinavian drink? What's a we've got?
That's why a vodka came to mind.
No, that's
got
schnapps.
Everton and Tottenham. We could maybe
Brian Sorensen and Jonas Eidevall, a shot of schnapps. At full time.
Brian Sorensen, he looks like a Jagerbomb man, actually.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can.
I don't know where you're getting that from.
Because he's always wearing his that cap. I don't know why. It just screams Jagerbomb to me.
Caps.
And the AirPod.
I'm wearing a cap.
And the AirPod, the one AirPod.
The
in.
One, yeah.
That screams Jagerbomb. All right, Kez, thank you very much for that question. We're going to be back on Thursday with a Copper 71 special. Lots of people may have seen that the documentary is out this week. It's out on Friday. We managed to go and see a little special preview screening. So we talk about the movie, and there's also an interview with one of the directors, Rachel Ramsey, in there. So make sure you check that out on Thursday. Kate, good to see you for the first time in a very long time.
Thank you. It's nice.
Good luck at the weekend. Jessie, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you soon. And yes, listener, catch you on Thursday.